The next LOS requires us to explain the derecognition of property, plant, and equipment and intangible assets. Eventually, long-lived assets are removed from the balance sheet. Derecognition occurs when assets are sold, exchanged, or abandoned. When a long-lived asset is sold, the asset is removed from the balance sheet, and the difference between the sale proceeds and the carrying value of the asset is reported as a gain or loss in the income statement. The carrying value is equal to original cost minus accumulated depreciation and any impairment charges. The gain or loss is usually reported in the income statement as a part of other gains and losses, or reported separately if material. Also, if the firm presents its cash flow statement using the indirect method, the gain or loss is removed from net income to compute cash flow from operations, because the proceeds from selling a long-lived asset are an investing cash inflow. If a long-lived asset is abandoned, the treatment is similar to a sale, except there are no proceeds. In this case, the carrying value of the asset is removed from the balance sheet, and a loss of that amount is recognized in the income statement. If a long-lived asset is exchanged for another asset, a gain or loss is computed by comparing the carrying value of the old asset with fair value of the old asset, or the fair value of the new asset if that value is clearly more evident. The carrying value of the old asset is removed from the balance sheet, and the new asset is recorded at its fair value. Next, we are asked to explain and evaluate how impairment, revaluation, and derecognition of property, plant, and equipment and intangible assets affect financial statements and ratios. Impairment reduces an asset's carrying value on the balance sheet. An impairment charge is recognized as a loss in the income statement, reducing assets and equity. In the year of impairment, return on assets and return on equity will decrease because the impairment charge reduces net income. In subsequent periods, net income will be higher than it would have been without the impairment charge because depreciation will be lower as the asset has a lower depreciable value. Both return on assets and return on equity will increase in periods after the impairment charge because both equity and assets will fall as a result of the impairment charge. Asset turnover will increase in the period in which the impairment charge is taken and in subsequent periods as well. Asset impairment has no impact on cash flow because the impairment does not reduce taxable income. It is an unrealized loss until the asset is disposed of. An impairment loss is an indication that the firm has not recognized sufficient depreciation or amortization expense and has overstated earnings as a result. The judgment required in determining asset impairments gives management considerable discretion about the timing and amounts of impairment charges. Consequently, impairment decisions present an opportunity for management to manipulate earnings. Waiting to recognize an impairment loss until a period of relatively high earnings would tend to smooth earnings. Alternatively, existing managements may take more impairment charges in periods when earnings will be poor due to macroeconomic or industry factors. New managements may also choose to take more or greater impairment charges when they take over. In either case, the resulting low earnings might not be perceived as the fault of management, and lower values for assets and equity give a boost to return on assets and return on equity going forward. Under U.S. GAAP, most long-lived assets are reported on the balance sheet at depreciated cost. Revaluing long-lived assets upward is generally prohibited. One exception relates to long-lived assets held for sale, for which prior impairment losses can be reversed. Under IFRS, firms can choose to use the revaluation model and report long-lived assets at their fair values. Firms can choose depreciated cost for some asset classes and fair value for others. Revaluing an asset's value upward will result in higher total assets and higher shareholders' equity, lower leverage ratios as measured by the debt-to-assets and debt-to-equity ratios, higher depreciation expense and thus lower profitability in periods after revaluation, lower return on assets and return on equity in periods after revaluation. However, if the increase in the asset value is the result of higher operating capacity, such higher capacity should result in higher revenues and thus higher earnings. An analyst should check the source of the appraisal that supports the revaluation. Appraisals from independent sources are usually more reliable than appraisals by management. Derecognition of an asset refers to its disposal by sale, exchange for another asset, or abandonment. Under the cost model, the carrying value of a long-lived asset is its historical cost minus accumulated depreciation or amortization adjusted for any impairment charges taken. Under the revaluation model, the carrying value of an asset is its value as of the last revaluation date, less any subsequent depreciation or amortization. The difference between the sale price and the carrying value is reported as a gain or loss on the income statement. Such gains and losses may be reported in other income or losses, or as a separate line item if the amount is material. When an asset is abandoned, the treatment is the same, but the sale price is zero and the loss is equal to the carrying value. If an asset is exchanged for another asset, the sale price is taken to be the fair value of the asset exchanged, or the value of the asset acquired if that value is more readily available. There are no cash flows with an exchange of assets, but gains or losses based on the difference between the carrying value and the price received for the exchanged asset are reported on the income statement, as they are with a sale. If the fair values of the assets cannot be reliably estimated, the price of the acquired asset is taken to be the carrying value of the exchanged asset, and no gains or losses are recorded. The next LOS requires us to describe the financial statement presentation of and disclosures relating to property, plant, and equipment and intangible assets. Under IFRS, the firm must disclose the following for each class of property, plant, and equipment: basis for measurement, usually historical cost; useful lives or depreciation rate; gross carrying value and accumulated depreciation; and reconciliation of carrying amounts from the beginning of the period to the end of the period. The firm must also disclose title restrictions and assets pledged as collateral and agreements to acquire property, plant, and equipment in the future. If the revaluation model is used, the firm must disclose the revaluation date, how fair value was determined, and carrying value using the historical cost model. Under IFRS, the disclosure requirements for intangible assets are similar to those for property, plant, and equipment, except that the firm must disclose whether the useful lives are finite or indefinite. For impaired assets, the firm must disclose amounts of impairment losses and reversals by asset class, where the losses and loss reversals are recognized in the income statement, and circumstances that cause the impairment loss or reversal. Under U.S. GAAP, the property, plant, and equipment disclosures include depreciation expense by period, balances of major classes of assets by nature and function, such as land, improvements, buildings, machinery, and furniture; accumulated depreciation by major classes or in total; and general description of depreciation methods used. Under U.S. GAAP, the disclosure requirements for intangible assets are similar to those for property, plant, and equipment. In addition, the firm must provide an estimate of amortization expense for the next 5 years. For impaired assets, the firm must disclose a description of the impaired asset, circumstances that caused the impairment, how fair value was determined, the amount of loss, and where the loss is recognized in the income statement. This leads us to the next LOS, which asks us to analyze and interpret financial statement disclosures regarding property, plant, and equipment and intangible assets. Financial statement disclosures provide an analyst considerable information about a company's fixed assets and depreciation and amortization methods. An analyst can use these data to estimate the average age of the firm's assets. The average age is useful for two reasons. Older, less efficient assets may make a firm less competitive, and the average age of assets helps an analyst to estimate the timing of major capital expenditures and a firm's future financing requirements. The level of detail provided in footnote disclosures regarding fixed assets and depreciation varies across firms. Because assets are often grouped by their useful lives, the following methods of estimating the average age, economic life, and remaining useful life of a firm's assets do not produce precise values, but they can highlight issues for further investigation. The average age of assets is estimated by dividing accumulated depreciation by annual depreciation expense. This calculation is more accurate for a firm that uses straight-line depreciation. The calculation can be significantly affected by the mix of assets. Total useful life is estimated as historical cost divided by annual depreciation expense. Historical cost is gross property, plant, and equipment before deducting accumulated depreciation. Remaining net useful life is estimated as ending net property, plant, and equipment divided by annual depreciation expense. Net property, plant, and equipment is equal to gross property, plant, and equipment minus accumulated depreciation. Another popular metric is the ratio of annual capital expenditures to depreciation expense. This ratio provides information about whether the firm is replacing its property, plant, and equipment at the same rate as its assets are being depreciated. The next LOS is to compare the financial reporting of investment property with that of property, plant, and equipment. Under IFRS, property that a firm owns for the purpose of collecting rental income, earning capital appreciation, or both, is classified as investment property. U.S. GAAP does not distinguish investment property from other kinds of long-lived assets. IFRS gives firms the choice of using a cost model or a fair value model when valuing investment property, if a fair value for the property can be established reliably. A firm generally must use the same valuation model, either cost or fair value, for all of its investment properties. The cost model for investment property is the same as the cost model for valuing property, plant, and equipment, but the fair value model is different from the revaluation model we described earlier. Recall that under the revaluation model, any revaluation above historical cost is recognized as revaluation surplus in owner's equity. For investment property, however, revaluation above historical cost is recognized as a gain on the income statement. Firms are required to disclose which valuation model they use for investment property. Firms that use the fair value model must state how they determine the fair value of investment property and reconcile its beginning and ending values. Firms that use the cost model must disclose the fair value of their investment property along with the disclosures that are required for other types of long-lived assets, such as useful lives and depreciation methods used. In some cases, a firm may change its use of a property, such that it becomes investment property or is no longer classified as investment property. For example, a firm may move its offices out of a building it owns and begin renting the space to others. If the firm uses the cost model, the property's carrying amount does not change when it is transferred into or out of investment property. But if the firm uses the fair value model, the financial statement treatment of the asset's value depends on the nature of the change. Transfers from owner-occupied to investment property are treated as revaluations. For transfers from inventory to investment property, the firm will recognize a gain or loss if fair value is different from the asset's carrying amount. For transfers out of investment property, the fair value of asset at the date of transfer will be its cost under its new classification. The final two LOS for this topic review concern leases. They ask us to explain and evaluate how leasing rather than purchasing assets affects financial statements and ratios, and to explain and evaluate how finance leases and operating leases affect financial statements and ratios from the perspective of both the lessor and the lessee. A lease is a contractual arrangement whereby the lessor, the owner of an asset, allows a lessee to use the asset for a specified period of time in return for periodic payments. Leases are classified as either finance leases or operating leases. In the United States, a finance lease is known as a capital lease. A finance lease is, in substance, a purchase of an asset that is financed with debt. Accordingly, at the inception of the lease, the lessee will add equal amounts to both assets and liabilities on the balance sheet. Over the term of the lease, the lessee will recognize depreciation expense on the asset and interest expense on the liability. This is the same treatment as if the asset were purchased with borrowed funds at the same asset value and terms as the finance lease. An operating lease is essentially a rental arrangement. No asset or liability is reported by the lessee, and the periodic lease payments are simply recognized as rental expense in the income statement. First, we will look at lease reporting by the lessee. The treatment of a lease as either an operating lease or finance lease determines whether or not the lease is reported on the balance sheet, how the lease expense is recognized in the income statement, and the classification of the lease payments on the cash flow statement. At the inception of an operating lease, no entry is made, though any related future obligations must be disclosed in the footnotes. During the term of the lease, rent expense equal to the lease payment is recognized in the lessee's income statement. In the cash flow statement, the lease payment is reported as an outflow from operating activities. At the inception of a finance lease, the lower of the present value of future minimum lease payments, or the fair value, is recognized as an asset and as a liability on the lessee's balance sheet. Over the term of the lease, the asset is depreciated, and depreciation expense, as well as interest expense, is reported in the income statement. Interest expense is equal to the lease liability at the beginning of the period, multiplied by the interest rate implicit in the lease. In the cash flow statement, the lease payment is allocated to interest expense and principal repayment, just as with an amortizing loan. The principal portion of the lease payment is equal to the total payment minus the interest expense for the period. Under U.S. GAAP, interest expense is reported in the cash flow statement as an outflow from operating activities, and the principal payment is reported as an outflow from financing activities. Now we will look at lease reporting from the lessor's perspective. At the inception of a finance lease, the lessor will recognize a sale equal to the present value of the lease payments and cost of goods sold equal to the carrying value of the asset. Just as with a normal sales transaction, the difference between the sales price and cost of goods sold is gross profit. If the lessor is not a manufacturer or dealer for the asset, but strictly offering financing in the form of a lease, the gross profit at the inception of the lease is zero. The present value of the lease payment equals the carrying value of the leased asset. The asset is removed from the balance sheet, and a lease receivable, equal to the present value of the lease payments, is created. As the lease payments are received, the principal portion of the payment reduces the lease receivable. It is as if the lessor sold the asset for its fair market value and loaned the lessee the purchase price. The lessor also recognizes interest income over the term of the lease. The interest revenue is equal to the lease receivable at the beginning of each period multiplied by the interest rate. In the cash flow statement, the interest revenue portion of the lease payment is reported as an inflow from operating activities, and the principal reduction is reported as an inflow from investing activities, just as with any amortizing loan the lessor may make. If a lease is treated as an operating lease, the lessor simply recognizes the lease payment as rental income. The lessor will keep the leased asset on its balance sheet and recognize depreciation expense over the asset's useful life. Total income over the life of the lease is the same for an operating lease and a finance lease. However, in the early years of the lease, the income reported from the finance lease is higher than the income reported from the operating lease. Just like an amortizing loan, the interest is higher in the early years. This situation reverses in the later years of the lease. In the cash flow statement, the classifications result in significant differences in cash flow from operations. Total cash flow is the same for an operating lease and a finance lease. However, cash flow from operations is higher with the operating lease. With a finance lease, the lease payment is separated into the interest portion, which is an operating cash inflow to the lessor, and the principal portion, which is an investing cash inflow.